is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Georges Clemenceau, the Prime Minister of France during the end of the First War and into the Versailles negotiations, said that making peace harder than waging war. Margaret Macmillan, the descendant of Lloyd George, writing most recently at Foreign Affairs, pointed to what went wrong in the First War. Both sides clung to the idea of military victory too long. It wasn't until the Germans, says Macmillan, Ms. Macmillan, the Germans accepted they were losing, did they sue for an armistice. Here we have a story in Ukraine that looks like a miniature version of the First War, and I welcome George Friedman, the founder and chairman of Geopolitical Futures, a subscription site, writing most recently about the challenge of Ukraine, Russia, and looking at the end, whatever that is, at the end of this present standoff, stalemate, frozen conflict. George, a very good evening to you. Both sides clinging to a military victory. That's what Ms. Macmillan says of the First War. Is that a fact here? Do both sides believe they can win through this on the ground, kinetically? Good evening to you.
I don't think they expect to win. They hope to win. They hope to proceed with the war so that when the war ends, they're in a acceptable position. And the problem they have is that neither side knows what an acceptable position is. It has to be really worked out. And they're quite right. Peace is difficult. But in this particular case, neither side has been beaten. That wasn't the case in World War I or World War II. Neither side needs to have to surrender. But they can just war go on.
Let's take them one at a time. First, Ukraine, smaller problem, led by Mr. Zelensky. Kyiv, its maximalist position is all Russians out, and then we'll talk negotiations. That is a position that so far has not proved fruitful. The spring offensive is either winding down, we're given operations details now and again, but there's a second war in the Middle East. The U.S. is completely overwhelmed with that challenge, so much so there are now headlines saying the Israelis are delaying the offensive because the U.S. is rushing air defenses to Israel, anticipating a wider war. All eyes on the Middle East. Kyiv, then, feels second fiddle. Does it have a position less than the maximalist position? Is anybody bringing that forward in Kyiv?
Well, first, the United States is not being torn apart. It has enough forces in that country and in Poland to sustain the war. And that's the problem. The Ukrainians do not want to give up part of their country. They're fighting for their homeland, and they want to hold on to it. They can do that only if the Americans support them, which we do for reasonable reasons. But now we are at the point where it's very clear that the Russians cannot beat them in the sense of occupying the territory, and they can't expel the Russians. So under these circumstances, they're going to have to find a middle ground, and that middle ground is going to have to include some sort of concession to the other. It takes time for them to come to that conclusion. But the United States can move the Ukrainians along. However, the Russians are more difficult. They never expected to be having this discussion when the war started. They thought they'd win.
Let's look at what the U.S. is doing to contribute to peace. The ATACMS, the F-16 promises, 31 main battle tanks of the Abrams, more resupply of 155 shells. I could go on. You know all this, George. That is not, those are not peace gestures. That says keep firing. And there are voices in Congress, you know them very well, that say this is a cheap victory over the Russian bad guys. We don't spend any blood. We spend some treasure and look at all that we've accomplished. Putin has rattled. Is that a false position that that Washington has?
Well, I would say that in any negotiation, you first sit down and put your money on the table, making it very clear that you're playing with the big boys. We've stopped the Russians from an easy victory that would have brought them to the border of NATO and would have allowed them to annihilate, in political terms, an independent country. So the achievement militarily was substantial. It blocked the Russians, who started the war, and having blocked the Russians, having started the war, it puts us in a negotiating position. Without this, there could be no negotiation. So I think the people in Congress who are doing that criticism really don't understand the success that we had.
Let's go to the Russian side, because you write that we need to look at the root cause, Russia's root cause. Russia's fearful of what, George? What are they frightened of? NATO?
They're right now some 200 miles from Moscow. We are. They defeated Napoleon. They defeated Hitler only because they had strategic depth. Do they think the Americans are going to attack? No, and Stalin didn't think Hitler would attack. The Russians have learned two things. First, don't engage in hopeful thoughts. And second, above all else, defeat the enemy by forcing them to move an extended period of time. Their fear is that the possible location of American troops, if we decide, is so close to Moscow, they won't have time to organize a defense.
So right now what we have is the Kremlin operating under the circumstance that it cannot relent, it cannot negotiate, because that will leave it exposed to NATO's close proximity to its capital. It won't be able to fall back. That was true beforehand with Warsaw. That was true beforehand with the Baltic states. Does that mean Russia will need NATO to reassure them that the Baltics are not a launch zone?
Well, they certainly would like one. I mean, they want to know that after they sign a treaty, they're not going to be attacked by the West. And that means it's some sort of control over Poland or some other control is not there. So we're talking about a peace discussion. The beginning of a peace discussion is each side determining what they would not give away, what they absolutely must have. And they will only succeed if both sides understand that thing and they craft a solution around it. So the idea here that we have not defeated Russia. Russia has not suffered a military collapse. The Russians have not defeated the Ukrainians. They have not suffered it. But each side could still lose. That's their reason for wanting a peace agreement. But that peace agreement has to include some sort of guarantee against ongoing war on both sides.
It feels as if we're just looking at not a peace, but a pause to rearm, George. That's what it feels like. And you write that Kiev is anxious about that, that if there's any cessation of hostilities, Russia will rearm, recalibrate, redraft, and overwhelm Kiev. Is that correct?
Well, Russia is going to rearm no matter what, and the Ukrainians will be armed by the Americans no matter what. This is not a love fest. This is an armistice, a peace talk. And the same forces that created the war are still there. So to have a successful peace, both sides must be strong. And this is a problem a lot of people have with the peace negotiation. They want a interim peace negotiation, and both sides should give up their weapons. And that's not going to happen. But they can be in a position they cannot be defeated.
The Russian Federation is not alone in this contest. It has allies, Tehran for the drones and possibly ballistic missiles, Beijing for money, buying the energy costs, and standing beside Putin with the No Limits Alliance, and now Pyongyang supporting Russia in terms of artillery shells in exchange for, well, I don't know, probably high-end ballistic missiles or a space program, something, whatever satisfies the Kim brethren. But in any event, Russia is not the sole adversary here. Is Russia stronger now than it was before the war because of its allies, because the Axis powers?
Well, first of all, Ukraine's allies are far more powerful than North Korea or something. The Russians had these allies before. They provided almost no support militarily to them. So China was their ally, and it didn't happen. So what you have to first understand is that Russia is, in a sense, alone. The countries that it had counted on at the beginning of this war didn't show up, and they have no confidence that they'll show up later. As for the other side, they're looking at NATO and almost unlimited American offensive weapons, and they feel enormously vulnerable. Now, we don't like to think of our enemies as feeling enormously vulnerable, but that is the case here. They feel vulnerable, and so do the Ukrainians.
And what we have then is the present standoff at the front line. As far as I can see, the line moves very, very slowly one way or the other, north or south in Donbass. And that is to continue for how long? Is there a timeline that you've read anywhere, George? If this isn't decided by X, then we'll have to do Y. Anything like that?
There's nothing like that, because both sides have committed themselves to the war, to this. And the fact is, it's a draw. Neither side can win the war. So this is a war that's over in the sense that it's not going to be a military success.
Right.
It's over, and no one knows how to end it. And so the real issue is to recognize that it's over in that sense. And I think the Ukrainians know that, and I think the Russians know that. And find a solution. But the solution must include defensive national sovereignty of both sides. It's not going to be kumbaya being sung and everybody happy. You have to have an agreement here that is enforced by each side, not by some third party. And that will allow them to, will force them to say, okay, the war is over and we're not going to attack you. But the worst thing that could happen is try a peace treaty, peace agreement, in which each side is not, has not built an invulnerable system.
We turn to what does work. And there is an example. It's 1945 to 1965. George Friedman is the guru, is the chairman, is the founder of Geopolitical Futures, and we're talking about the Ukraine war. At the same time, we're looking at the Mideast war, or worse. I'm John Biden.